Section 7 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 2, Selfhood, Part 4. Powers unseen and unknown are the fountains of life. No animal but kenneth that sunlight is warm. No dog but shifteth posture with the shifting shade reasonably as we. But man maketh a dial for it to measure his day, and by his abstract intellect hath taken it for the source and very cause of life, then by science unravelling its physical rays, he hath separated some and found some properties. But of the whole he knoweth that his analysis hath not approached the secret of their living power. Nor hath man ever a doubt that mere objects of sense affect his mental states, nor that the mind in turn promoteth the action and function of his animal life in its organs and bones. The Greek astronomer, gazing with naked eye into the starry night, forgat his science, and in transport of spirit his mortal lot. Then seemed it to him as if his feet touched earth no longer.
Alla per altoi, Zani,
said he, in the treasured words that keep his joy from death.
Theo Trofeos, pimple my ambrosiers.
Now, this imagination of awe and ecstasy, being proper and common in man, and where lacking or dull, so ready to suggestion, it seemeth as though the eye had some spiritual vision, as if the idea of space, and also of God, existed in the midnight skies, and thus men came to think that their corporeal sense encountered reality in the appearance of things, and, stirred by influences that outreaching reason kindled unknown desires,
their awed souls fell to prayer that the great maker of all would reveal his being.
If so be, then, that reason, our teacher in all the schools, owneth to existences beyond its grasp, whereon its richer faculties depend, and that those powers are ever-present, influencing the unconscious mind in its native function to inspire the will, 'twould seem that as the wakened mind, fashioned toward intellect, so the dark workings of his animal instinct, faced in a new perspective toward spiritual sight. And thus man's trouble came of their divergency. For spiritual perception, vague and uncontrolled, being independent of the abstract intelligence, he is disconcerted twixt their rival promises, and, doubtful of his road, he wavereth, following now one, now the other. And thus I stand where I conclude that man's true wisdom were a reasoned harmony and correlation of these divergent faculties. This were the bridge which all men who can see the abyss have reasonably and instinctively desired to build, and all their sacraments and mysteries whatsoe'er attempt to build it, from devout Pythagoras to the last psychologist of Nancy or of Vienna. And between spiritual emotion and sensuous form, the same living compact maketh our art, wherein material appearances engage the soul's depth. And if, in men untrained without habit of thought, the ear is more aesthetic than the eye is, this cometh from that sense being the earlier endowed in animals, who, though they be all vacant in a picture gallery, nor see themselves in a mirror, attend to music and yield to fascination or vague wonder thereat. So if we, changing Plato's old difficult term, should rename his ideas influences, there is none would miss his meaning, nor, by nebulous logic, wish to refute his doctrine that indeed there are eternal essences that exist in themselves, supreme efficient causes of the thoughts of men. What is beauty, saith my sufferings then? I answer the lover and poet in my loose Alexandrines. Beauty is the highest of all these occult influences, the quality of appearances that through the sense wakeneth spiritual emotion in the mind of man. And art, as it createth new forms of beauty, awakeneth new ideas that advance the spirit in the life of reason to the wisdom of God. But highest art must be rare as native faculty is, and her surprise of magic winneth favour of men more than her inspiration. Most are led away by fair-seeming pretences, which, being wrought for gain, pursue the ephemeral fashion that assureth it, and their thin influences are of the same low grade as the unaccomplished forms. Their poverty is exposed when they would stake their charm on ethic excellence. For then weak simulations of virtues appear, such as convention approveth, but not virtue itself, though not void of all good. And, as I read, 'twas this that Benvenuto intended, saying that not only virtue was memorable, but things so truly done that they were like to virtue, and thus prefaced his book, thinking to justify both himself and his works. The authority of reason, therefore, relieth at last hereon, that her discernment of spiritual things, the ideas of beauty, is her conscience of instinct upgrown in her, as she unto conscience of all upgrew from lower to higher, to conscience of beauty judging itself by its own beauteous judgment. And of war she would say, it ranketh with those things that are like unto virtue, but not virtue itself. Rather, in the conscience of spiritual beauty, a vice that needeth expert horsemanship to curb, yet being native in the sinew of selfhood, the life of things, the pride of animals and virtue of savagery, so long as men be savage, such it remaineth, and mid the smoke and gas of its new armoury still, with its tattered columns and gilt swords of state, retaineth its old glory untarnished. Heroism, self-sacrifice, discipline, and those hardy virtues of courage honoured in Brasidas, without which man's personality were meaner than the brute's. Who hath not known this picture, on a hot afternoon of our high summer in August, at the country seat of some vexed politician, if in their flashing cars the county folk gather to his holiday garden, where for their entertainment he hath outspread the lawns with tents and furnished tables, flags and tennis nets, if haply he have set up to dignify his grounds a classic statue of marble, fetched by ship from Greece, that standeth there in true ideal nakedness, mid parasols and silks, how with blank shadowed eyes it looketh from all these aimless idlers there that flaunt around, now and again blurting perchance a shamefast shallow tribute to its beauteous presence. 'Tis very like among common concourse of men, who, twixt care of comfort and zeal in worldly affairs, have proved serving two masters the vanity of both, when a true soldier appeareth, one compact at heart of sterner virtues and modesty of maintenance, mute witness and martyr of spiritual faith, a man ready at call to render his life to keep his soul. All virtue is in her shape so lovely, that at sight her lover is enamoured even of her native face. And here I part from Aristotle, agreeing else that a good disposition is goddess' happiest gift. Without which, as he addeth, virtue is unteachable, but in minds well disposed may be by reason upbuilt. No man cometh, said she, unto wisdom but by me. But when he would exalt this guiding principle, to be that part whereby we are in likeness with God, whose being, saith he, lieth in the unbroken exercise of absolute intellect, which for their happiness mankind should strive to attain, I halt thereat, and this marreth my full accord where, in a famous text, he hath made desire to be the prime mover of all. Because the arch-thinker's heaven cannot move my desire, nor doth his pensive deity make call on my love. I see the emotion of saints, lovers, and poets all to be the kindling of some personality by an eternizing passion, and that God's worshipper, looking on any beauty, falleth straightway in love. And that love is a fire in whose devouring flames all earthly ills are consumed, and at least flash of it be only a faint radiancy. The freed soul glimpseth, nay, e'en may think to have felt some initiate foretaste of that mystic rapture, the consummation of which is the absorption of selfhood
in the being of God.
Ideas and influences spiritually discerned are of their essence pure, but in the lot of man nothing is wholly pure. Yet all hindrance to good, be good and evil two in love, or one in strife, maketh occasion for it, by contrast heightening, by challenge and revelry, arousing virtue to act. Hence 'twill not be with men only of contention and hate, nor only with the ambitious and disorderly, that combat findeth favour. Honest men, good and true, who seek peace and ensue it, seeking war as the field for exercise of spirit, that else might fust unused, embrace the good,
and cavil not the inherent terms, rather welcoming hardship,
which by fraying cowards purgeth heroic ranks, and battle rallieth all keen-hearted sportsmen, and the brave gamesters of life, adventurers whose joy danceth on peril's edge, for whom life hath no relish save in danger of death, who love sport for its hazard, and of all their sports, where hazard is at highest, look to find the best there on the field, where hourly they may stake their all. And 'tis because they feel their spirit's ecstasy in owing naught to reason, but exultantly blendeth with the old selfhood wherefrom it sprang. 'Tis thus they can be friendly at heart with nature's heartlessness, nor heed the wrongs and cruelties that come and pass, overlooked as by men who have suffered not nor seen. But we who have seen, condemned in savage self-defence, to train our peaceful folk in the instruments of death, and of massacre and mourning, have suffered 4 years, we have no need to recount in vindication of peace sorrows which no glory of heroism can atone, horrors which to forget were cowardice and wrong, dishonesty of heart and repudiation of soul, yet gladly might forget in the passing of pain. And memory is so complacent that we well may fear lest our children forget, and see nature already, regardless how her fractious babe had scratched her cheek, hath with her showy invincibles retaken amain the trenches and reclothed the devastated lands. See how with placid mien Athena unhelmeted, re-entering, hath possessed her desolated halls, how her musical temples and grave schools are thronged with fresh youth, eager as ever with the old books and games, their live abounding mirth re-echoing from the walls, where among antique monuments their brothers' names in long death roll await the mellowing touch of time. And why not we forget? How is't that we dare not wish to forget and cut this canker of memory from us, as men diseased in one part of their flesh find health in mutilation, as if our agony were a boon to keep, when in its own happy riddance 'twould die off in the natural oblivion of things, and with our follies fade. So, each one for himself, disbanding his self-share, reason would dissipate its own delusion, and lay that spectre of our dismay, the accumulation of griefs,
to which war hath no right prior or prerogative.
Misery's layers thick, and horrors worse, when plague invaded the cities, Athens or London, raging with polluted flood in every house, and with revolting torture racked the folk to loathsome deaths, nor men kenned as they fell, desperately unrepentant to the scourge of God, how 'twas the crowded foulness of their own bodies punished them so. Alas, then, in what plight are we, knowing 'twas man's crowded uncleanness of soul that brought our plague, which yet we could not cure nor stay? For reason had lost control of his hot-tempered steed, and taken himself infection of the wild brute's madness. So when its fire slackened and the fierce fight wore out, our fevered pulse showed no sober return of health. Amid the flimsy joy of the uproarious city, my spirit, on those first jubilant days of armistice, was heavier within me, and felt a profounder fear than ever it knew in all the war's darkest dismay. End of section 7. End of book 2. Selfhood.